linguistic art chicks.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Well, as I'm sure you already know, our psychedelic community lost one of its founding fathers, as Dr. Albert Hofmann, the discoverer of LSD, died yesterday. And for all of us, of course, this feels like a great loss. Even though Dr. Hofmann lived to be 102 years old, it's still difficult to accept the fact that he's gone. And my first impulse was to postpone today's program and do a special tribute to the good doctor. But then it dawned on me that the talk I'm going to play today, and the one I'd planned on playing all along, the one that was given by Anne and Sasha Shulgin at the 2005 Mind States Conference, is even more appropriate because, at least in my humble opinion, the only chemist in the last 100 years who is equal in stature to Dr. Hofmann is Dr. Alexander Shulgin, or Sasha, as he prefers to be called. And I'll have some more to say about how and why I've come to that conclusion after we hear the Shulgin's talk. But first, I want to give my deep thanks to Eric K. and Kyle N., both of whom sent in donations to help offset the expenses of these podcasts. So, a big thank you, Eric and Kyle. Your support means a lot to me and to a lot of other people all around this little planet. Now, getting to today's program, as I just mentioned, it's a talk given by Anne and Sasha Shulgin. And unless you are new to these podcasts, you are already aware that Sasha has undergone some major surgery recently. And by the way, thanks to all of you who have gone to the caringbridge.org/Sasha Shulgin site to leave your well wishes. Anne has been printing them out regularly and reading them to Sasha. So far, there have been over 200 people who have left a comment there, and I'd like to think that many of them are our fellow saloners. And since I know that you might be commuting to work right now and don't have access to the net, I'll read Anne's latest posting, which is from a couple of days ago. She says, "Sasha is getting better every day, but slowly. Not from my point of view, but from his. He's pretty tired by the end of the day and doesn't see why that should be so. We all get together and yell at him," in parentheses, "not really." And then in all caps, she writes, "Sasha, you are repairing fantastically well. Please don't rush it. Remember, the doctor said 2 to 3 months, not 2 to 3 days. And then she continues, "In any case, he's back at work with Tanya on the book, which should be ready for editing within a few weeks. He's happiest when he can concentrate on the book, although the frustration of the macular degeneration gets pretty intense at times. After the book is turned over to the editors, he'll get back into the lab with the help of Tanya and another very good friend who will help read labels and pour liquids from one beaker into another, etc. I'll keep updating every few days if you're still reading these notes. Blessings on all of you, and thank you, Anne." Now, one of the things that you may not be aware of, if you've only heard recordings of Sasha's talks but haven't been with him in person, is the fact that he has a truly great sense of humor and will tease you a bit if you aren't watching out for that zinger that he'll send your way every once in a while. So when you hear this talk in just a minute, it might be helpful to keep in mind that Sasha had a huge smile on his face during this entire session. Fortunately, Anne came to the rescue with that soft, beautiful, and ever so consoling voice of hers to keep things on track. And yes, to many of you who have written and asked for me to podcast more Anne Shulgin, I do plan on doing that soon. Right now, the only other recording I have of hers is one that has a loud air conditioner hum in the background, but I'm trying to get some more recordings and hope to pass them along to you as soon as I can. Now that I think of it, the request for more talks by Anne outnumbers those kinds of requests for anybody else, including Terrence McKenna. And, sorry to say, even more than requests for Sasha. But today we're going to get them both in a similar setting to the one from my podcast number 53, which was in October of 2006, where they had the Ask the Shulgins Q&A sessions from Burning Man that year. And today's Q&A was actually held a year earlier at the Mind States Conference. Now, I'm going to warn you in advance that this session begins with what I consider some heavy-duty chemistry. And since I remember nothing from my two college chemistry courses, I don't grok the nuts and bolts of what they are saying. But it's quite obvious that these young chemists who are asking these questions aren't just doing so out of idle curiosity. These are the people who are now filling the shoes of Dr. Hoffman, and fortunately they have someone to ask these questions of who is equally as well informed about psychedelic chemistry as was Uncle Albert. And so if you're not a chemist yourself, instead of just tuning out the detailed questions and answers about chemistry, try to comprehend the fact that these chemists are looking at atomic structures, comparing them with other chemicals they know, and then not only speculating on what would happen if they move a single atom to another place, but actually build these new molecules and then test it on themselves. This is truly the great unknown, my friends, and these are the people who are opening the gates so that us non-chemists can go exploring. But please don't think it's all chemistry today. There are quite a few gems sprinkled in this unstructured Q&A session, including something I didn't know before about testing for some of the two C's. So let's begin with Susan Blackmore's introduction of Anne and Sasha.
Now, what on earth do I say? 2 years ago, I met Sasha and Anne for the first time, and I was so frightened isn't the right word, just kind of awed, and, you know, how can I introduce them? Well, you were all there, weren't you? But now I've met them and found that they're, well, human, in spite of all the amazing things they've done. I mean, surely there's no couple on the planet like this. Sasha, a chemist who has designed more drugs than anyone else on the planet, and both of them who... Both of them who have taken more drugs, more variety of drugs than anyone on this planet. And here they are surviving to tell the tale, not only surviving, but surviving wonderfully. And what courage they must have to just go into all of these things with an open mind, prepared to take the risks, which undoubtedly are great, determined to learn from it, to write their books, Pikal and Tikal, that tell us all about it, explain the chemistry, explain the experiences, and now here they are to answer your questions. So, thank you very much for coming again, and would you please, as before, if you want to ask a question, line up by the microphones, and off you go.
You have to make sure that, it's working. Hooray.
Does this one work too?
Yep.
Okay.
Good. Hello.
How do you do?
Hi.
Do speak first if you want before we have the question.
Does anyone need a summary of who we are and what we do? Or
yeah.
Yes?
Yeah. Why don't you explain? Because you know better than I do.
Okay. Oops. Seriously?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. We've only got an hour. This gentleman, known as Sasha, is, I think at present, he's probably the world's top researcher in the effect of psychedelic drugs on human beings. Most people who deal in this area are using the drugs or experimenting on animals. And, well, there is in this field a term, LAB, I think it is.
LAB, right.
LAB, which means...
Lab experiments, LAB. It's short for large animal biochemistry.
Right, large animal being human beings, yes. The thing we've also done at a certain point in the 80s, I think, Sasha published everything that he had discovered, and that included dosage levels and their effects in humans, etc., etc. He was publishing in the Journal of Medicinal Chemistry and other scientific journals who have peer review. But at a certain point, and I forget when was it that the lawyers for those journals got cold feet?
It's in the 1980s. the legal advisors of various editors of the various medical journals and pharmacological journals, were advising the editors not to let human experiments be published unless they were had been approved by and had been overseen by a research advisory panel of some type. And so in our little research group, we decided to be a research advisory panel and advise ourselves as to how we should do things. And that went along for about 2 or 3 years, and then that was felt to be uncomfortable. The journal was strictly a little bit uncomfortable publishing human data that did not come from known clinical sources.
Well, everybody was getting cold feet. It was the beginning of the war on drugs in general. And they decided it was just too risky. Actually, our research group did include the kind of people who are supposed to be included in a, what do you call it, advisory panel. A psychiatrist and
lawyers, psychologists.
Yeah, not too many lawyers. So anyway, that was the point at which we began to think that the best thing to do was to put all this information, all this knowledge, into a different form, one that did not depend on peer review. And so we began writing the first book, which was PCAL. And
we very, very cautiously indicated that it was a fictional book.
Yeah.
So there'd be no complications.
The chemistry is not fictional.
Well, maybe it is. No. Okay.
Nope. But the rest of the story, you might say, is nonfiction here and there. Let's put it that way. But some of it is fictional. And as far as the authorities go, it most definitely is a fictional story. And as far as my children go, it certainly is fictional because there's a lot of sex in it. So, and parents don't do that kind of thing.
It's amazing what children don't know their parents do.
They don't want to know. Children prefer not to know. So that was the beginning of the writing, and I was doing work as a lay therapist at that time, and I did that for about 2.5 years, and that was incredible work, using MDMA before it became illegal. And let me tell you, MDMA is an extraordinary psychotherapeutic drug. And I'm so happy to know that various places around the world, it's now being used in what I think is going to be its most most important way, and that is dealing with PTSD, which is post-traumatic stress disorder. Especially for veterans of war, I think MDMA is going to save a lot of sanity. And anyway, after MDMA became illegal and the idea of the book became more important, I quit the therapy, having learned a tremendous lot, and we began writing PCAL. We submitted the manuscript to a very good friend who's a publisher, and he sent it back saying, "I wish I could, but it's too political." We understood, and we did not submit the manuscript to anyone else. And we went ahead and did our own publishing, and we have been delighted to have done so ever since. And the second book is TCAL. Oh, the first book, PCAL, P-I-H-K-A-L, stands for Phenethylamines I Have Known and Loved. That was Sasha's idea. And the second book is Tryptamines I Have Known and Loved. And people who don't know a thing about chemistry enjoy the first half of the book, which is the story. And those who are pure chemists ignore the first half and just go straight to the chemistry. And that's pretty much... for the rest, you have to read the books. that's sort of the best summary I could give. You got anything more?
No, I think it's beautiful. Thank you.
Okay, all right. Any, now, questions, for heaven's sake. And if there are no questions, we're in real trouble. Yeah.
Hi. As a chemist, the best way to express my esteem and appreciation is to ask a chemistry question. In PiCal, you say that 2CH is likely to be not psychoactive because it would get chewed up by the monoamine oxidases. I'm wondering why substitution at the 4 position would inhibit that, as it does with 2CB and 2CD and so on. That's the first question. The second is more in general. Perhaps I should let you answer that, and I'll ask the second one.
Okay, the question basically, why are some of these phenethylamines that are presumably destroyed by monoamine oxidase inhibitors, why are they active? Well, there are a number of reasons they might be. One is the monoamine oxidase monoamine oxidase enzyme could remove the amine group, but we don't know what the functional molecule is. It could very well be that the result of that deamination produces a material in a site, in a location, that is the active component. A lot of these, most of these, I have not even looked at the urinary content, urinary metabolites, to see what is in there. For example, I found that an experiment with mescaline, which is, again, a phenethylamine. It should, quote, not be active. And I made some C14-labeled mescaline and took and divided it into 3 portions, about 5 microcuries each. And one was the pure material that I had made. It was, I think it's about 40 micrograms of material. Then I diluted another batch to about 2 or 3 milligrams, and a third batch to 150 milligrams with cold mescaline. And to see it over the course of 3 or 4 weeks, I took each of the 3 samples and collected my urine. And I found in the low, low concentrations and the medium concentrations, the material was almost totally destroyed by the monoamine oxidase. I presume by monoamine oxidase, because I did find the C14 in the acidic fraction. In the higher levels, there was a about 75% destruction, about 25% went through unchanged or as other demethylated metabolites. And I suspect that the large dosage is what allowed the mescaline to be realized. And at small levels, small doses, it's just totally destroyed. I think a challenge to this would be to try some of these compounds using monoamine oxidase inhibitors, sort of an ayahuasca concept, where you have a material that is not orally active or shouldn't be orally active and becomes so in the presence of an inhibitor of that enzyme system. So it may well be that these materials that are active are extremely active, and in the presence of a monoamine oxidase inhibitor, their potency may be much higher than we suspect.
Thank you very much.
Was there a second part of the question?
The second part is, or the second question is, the psychedelics you've designed all have their unique character. Clearly, there's so much more going on than just one or two, you know, different receptors, 5-HT2A, 5-HT2C. Why do you suppose that is? Would you say there's just a bunch of subtypes of receptors or a symphony of interactions among them? Or how would you speculate biologically the subtle differences between, you know, a 2CB and a 2CI, something like that?
Well, first of all, I don't know where the materials are active. Since one can look where the serotonin agonists go, one can suspect that serotonin, there's a new subdivision, I think, every 3 weeks, 5-HT2, 5-HT2A, 2C. They find other compounds that are agonists to another type of serotonin. So it may be a display of different of distribution amongst different serotonin receptors. But I believe that the involvement of the neurotransmitters as an explanation is partly compromised by the fact that neurotransmitters, we can see where they are, and we don't know where these things are in their effectiveness. A good example of this is an experiment, I think I wrote a note on it, in which DOB is a very potent psychedelic. It is very long-lived, very slow onset, very long-lived.
It's a weekend trip.
Yeah. Yeah, a long weekend. Be cautious of DOI, which can be equally long and equally potent. But what I did, we're working with some friends up at Lawrence Lab, actually at Donner Lab in Berkeley. Oh, that's a marvelous thing. We were working in Berkeley, and we had access to the cyclotron, we had access to the gamma scanners, anything we wanted. The only caution they extended us is, when you leave, be sure you have turned the lights off and locked the door, which is beautiful. So we did all kinds of marvelous things. We made some DOB labeled with bromine 77 and some with bromine 82. And then we had access to a gamma, it's a bed that goes over a gamma detector, and you lie in the bed and you go head first over the detector, and it scans the body from the head to the foot. And you go back and do it again and do it again. And this scanning is put onto an oscilloscope, and vertical raster. And so you actually then can get a moving picture of the motion of the radioactivity in the body. You don't know what form, chemically form, that radioactivity is in, because all you can see is where the gamma rays are coming from. But it does allow you to see that just if you get an injection, we took it intravenously, a little sloppy injection, you can see a little bit of residual C14 around the, probably bromine 77 around the area of the injection. And we looked with great interest to see how fast it would go to the brain and how long it would stay in the brain, where in the brain it went. And my desire was to see it all the way to the final metabolic end so I could determine the where the bromine went. We never saw ionic bromines. The bromine stayed on the molecule. To our amazement, the material didn't go to the brain. It went to the lung. And the level in the lung built up quite not very high, but as the most, the lung is a very potent metabolic organ, probably next to the liver is the most potent metabolic organ. And the amount of accumulation of the radiochemical, I presume still DOB, but I don't know what its chemical status is, built up in the lung, and then after a while it began dropping down, and then it began accumulating in the brain. So I have a strong suspicion that the DOB goes in, it is changed to something else, and that change is occurring probably in the lung, and then that something else by circulation goes into the brain, and there it builds up in the brain. So you're seeing a metabolite. And I did all the chemistry I could, and I could not determine, isolate that metabolite and know what it is. So there's an example of how does it work. It works by enzymatic change, and yet you can't argue a mechanism of action of the original compound, because the original compound may not be contributing to the activity in the body.
But it's possible that it is, right?
It's possible that it is.
Okay. How long did it take before the lung, the apparent lung effect started going to the brain?
I remember 2 to 3 hours.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Great.
Yep, yeah,
fine.
Sure.
Absolutely. Bless you.
In taking MDA for about 4 years, maybe 12 times in that period, I find that I may have some memory problems in that area. Maybe I'm just blaming MDA on it, but it just seems like there's some correlation between those two things. Is that a possibility?
It is a possibility. I really don't know. MDA was originally...
No, MDMA.
I'm sorry, you said MDMA or MDA?
MDMA.
Oh, I'm sorry. I heard it as MDA.
I might have said that.
I forgot what the question was.
Well, yeah.
I worked on an MDA history, and
seriously, may I ask, are you over 35?
I'm 61.
Okay, well, I think what we've observed is that anybody over 35 starts having gradual but distinct problems with memory. It's part of the aging process. It just happens. I don't think it's got anything to do with MDMA, because I went through about one and a half to 2 years. This is before we knew that MDMA loses its effect if you use it too often. And I used it once a week for over 1.5 years. In fact, most of what my part of Pical, the first book, was written under the influence of MDMA because it was my writing material. It was an extraordinary material for writing. It just kept things flowing. And my memory is not too hot, but it's certainly no worse than that of my friends who've never tried anything in the way of a drug, so I very much doubt it.
Okay. And I'm even older than Anne, and I have noticed this memory deterioration, and I'm not a chronic user or a regular user of MDMA. In fact, I haven't used it for a decade or more. And yet the memory is slowly deteriorating. I refer to it by the term of JOA, which is juvenile onset Alzheimer's. But there is a tendency, for example, if you have a clue of something, as I did with MDA, and I begin working out the answer of MDA, and I discover I had heard the wrong thing, and I don't remember what the question was. I mean, this is a blatant example of this memory problem. You come to the end of a sentence, you have to reread your sentence, know how you started the sentence. This is bad.
It's okay. I remember a time when it was just not age, but stress. I was with a group of people I didn't know, and I was about to introduce my oldest son to those people and realize I didn't remember his name. It took a few seconds, you know, to just relax myself, and it all came back. I mean, stress will cause that also. Yeah,
there's many other neurotransmitter systems, and I was wondering if you were going to be doing any experiments with them. For example, there's 14 known currently cholinergic subtypes of receptors. One of them provides pain relief as powerful as morphine. Another one is involved in memory, and especially the cholinergic nervous system is what tends to go out more and more as you get older and older. Ditran, for example, an anticholinergic, has some fascinating long-term therapeutic effects. I was wondering if you're going to be doing any experiments in other neurotransmission systems, particularly the cholinergic system.
The difficulty with a lot of the experiments that are done, neurological agonist experiments, are done in animals, because you like to be able to give the animal something or other and then take out the brain and slice it up and see where the radioactivity went, and this is not very comfortably done with humans. So the difficulty, again, that I add to this is that I can look at these things not as brain enhancers or brain modifiers, but as mind modifiers. And I'm not quite sure the connection between the brain and the mind is something that I find to be... I want to get into memes here in a moment. There is no way of getting at the human mind easily as an experiment. And since we can get at the neuroreceptor sites, the various neuroagonist sites, and to tell where they are and where material goes relative to them, we tend to like looking under the light for the lost keys. It's easier to see there. That may not be where the key is to be found. But you tend to look where things are more easily seen. I remember a seminar I was given at Lawrence Lab about 10 or 15 years ago, and it said the explanation of the action of psychedelics, something by someone in a big government office somewhere back in the East Coast, something National Institute of Health. And I was very interested because I was curious what action they would, how they explain the activity of these mind chemicals without going into animals. And the experiment, the talk was totally about animals, brain distribution, where these materials went, what receptors they were associated with. And I went up to the lecturer afterwards and I said, I understood you're going to talk about the mechanism of action of these materials, and all you did was talk about the distribution in the brain, in the animal brain. Well, that's all we can measure. So again, the idea, this is what can be seen, this is what's reported, this is what people tend to assimilate as being the target of the compounds. And the truth is, maybe these materials don't affect neurotransmitters at all. Maybe it's a distribution of this lipophilic thing with that hypo something or other thing in that constitutes the structure of the mind and not the brain. What was that experiment on the understanding? Oh, yeah, the one of the five schizophrenics and five normals. Remember that I told you about that?
Oh, yeah.
This is a beautiful example of what we know about mind chemistry. at Donner Lab, oh, some 15, 20, 25, maybe 30 years ago, it was believed at that time that methionine was a very great aggravator of schizophrenic syndrome. It did not have any action on normal people, but on schizophrenics it made them more difficult to handle and more difficult to assimilate behavior changes. And so I made up some S-adenosine methionine, as I remember, radio-labeled, and we had access to PET scanning. And we got five schizophrenics from Mendocino Hospital and five normals from the lab there, which was a bit harder to do, but we did get five. And gave them enough activity of the S-adenosine methionine that we could get good PET scans just above the earlobes across the brain. And we ended up with 10 pictures, five of them from the schizophrenics and five of them from the normals. And all 10 pictures were totally, totally different from one another. There's no connection of distribution that you could find that would lean toward one or lean toward the other of the two human groups. And every time people came in from the East Coast to visit the lab, we'd have these 10 pictures on the wall. And we'd ask them, who do you think, which are the ones of the normals and which are the ones of the schizophrenics? And we tallied the answers, and there was absolutely no total random response. But the fascinating thing is, about 3 or 4 months later, one of the schizophrenic patients, volunteers, came in and talked to my friend, who's the one who set up the experiment, and he saw the 10 pictures on the wall. And he said, oh, are those the 10 pictures you took of us? No, one each of you, one picture from each of you. Oh, but then these, I'm one of these 10, right? He said, yes. Tony said, yes. He said, that's me, he said, pointing at that picture, and he was right. He picked his own brain scan out of one chance in 10 if it's random, but he picked it correctly. So Tony very casually said, hey, you're right, how'd you know? Oh, he said, you see this little almost star-shaped thing down here in the lower right corner? I see it all the time. And so this is the kind of information that you cannot get from animal studies, but it's also it emphasizes the absolute ignorance we have as to the function, the mechanism of operation of the mind.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question about the dragonfly series of compounds. I haven't been able to find too much information on it, so I've only learned of it recently, but can you, in your opinion, tell me the most desirable ring substitution pattern to go between the rings? And has anyone or yourself experimented with a Aminorex type derivative of that with the oxalone ring on the side?
Could you repeat that slower, please? I'm really not trying to make fun of you. It's just that the sound is a little difficult.
Yes, I was asking about the dragonfly compounds. What you would say the most desirable substitution is to go in between the furan rings, and has anyone experimented with an Aminorex type side chain to go on that compound?
What kind of
Aminorex side chain?
Okay. To my knowledge, the Aminorex side chain has not been put on the dragonflies. You have what I call the pseudo-flies, the flies, and the dragonflies. This is a chemical game of looking at the what I call the dirty pictures, the molecular structures. You take an aromatic ring and you attach a dihydrofuran on one side, and the dihydrofuran the other way on the other side. You have, in essence, a molecule, that central molecule with two rings fused on each side of the center. And that looks like the wings of an insect. So these were called flies. The ordinary fly is the dihydrofuran. In the para position, there is a bromine or a cyanide nitrile group or a methoxy. And in the other position of the chain, there is either a phenethylamine or an amphetamine. A little bit difficult to make. Some of them are rather effectively quite potent. They've been studied in Purdue, in Nichols' lab, as the relationship to various serotonin receptors. And I am personally familiar, Anne and I are personally familiar, with only one of them in any depth, and that is the bromo fly, 2CB fly, I should say. It's a compound of the bromine in the para position. The two dihydrofurans are inverted, so the oxygens are para to one another. And the chain itself is the phenethylamine. Active at 8 or 10 milligrams, I think, level.
Absolutely divine. Wonderful. Anyway.
I won't go into the sex thing.
No.
No, okay, fine. If you aromatize the rings on the side, the amphetamine chain ups the activity by a factor of about 10, a dosage of the corresponding 2C, 2C, no, B fly would be active at about maybe 1 milligram orally. If you aromatize the two rings and make the corresponding hydro, not hydro, but the furans themselves, we call these dragonflies because they are active at about 100 micrograms, but not orally. A milligram has no effect orally, but by parenteral injection, active at about 100 micrograms. So the compounds could be quite interesting. Something, as was mentioned, with the Aminorex extension on the chain. To my knowledge, it's never been synthesized.
Thank you.
I forget which side that came from.
Okay. Hello.
Over there.
Oh. Hi. My question is, do 2CB, 2CI, or any of the other 2Cs show up on a standard drug test?
I got a 2CB, 2CI, and...
Show up on a standard blood test?
Show up, oh.
Urine test.
I haven't the slightest idea. That Sasha might have an idea.
How do you define a standard blood test?
No, not a standard blood test, a standard drug test, like urine test.
Drug test. It depends when, I think.
No, I don't even know if they have been standardized for these drugs, 2CB and 2CI.
That's probably...
I have to admit I'm innocent as to how the two compounds are metabolized. I've never bothered looking at my urine when I was first working with them. If they are metabolized as salicylic acid, which is a very reasonable metabolic end product, I would say would not show it up at all. I don't know what a standard urine test, I presume you had in mind.
Mm-hmm.
The amounts that would be present would be very small, and I would wager that most urine tests are standardized toward things that are most apt to be seen, such as marijuana or amphetamine or methamphetamine or cocaine, mm-hmm, or opium, things that you can get color tests for. And the color test is a presumptive test. And if it is negative, there is no drug thought to be present. If it's positive, it really justifies a more thorough and a more exacting analysis, because a positive color test can be to another compound entirely than what you think it may be due to. So a presumptive test, a color test, test of that type is only if positive, justifies going to the expense of a more exacting test. I really cannot conceive of a color test that would show positive with 2CB or 2CI in urine, because the amounts there are so small.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering, there's been some speculation online, you know, that may be dubious as to whether there's psychedelic Aminorex or piperazine analogs. I'm just wondering if you have any information if that's a possibility. There are, psychedelic piperazine or Aminorex analogs that can be synthesized.
Are you saying piperazines?
Yeah.
And hydrazine, I think.
No, it's piperazines, like, you know.
Hydrazine in place of the amine group?
No, I was saying, there's been speculation online that there's possible analogs of Aminorex or piperazines that may be psychedelic, and I'm wondering if you can validate that. Or if you know of any possibilities.
I have to answer the question in a general sense. There are many speculations as to varieties of simpler molecules. Say, you mentioned, I think, piperazines, hydrazines, but also the various benzylamines that are known to be, when substituted, being stimulants. And a lot of these materials... A lot of materials that are psychedelic are based upon stimulant nuclei. Those you have amphetamine, for example, methamphetamine, and without substitution is a stimulant, but with substitution it falls into the psychedelic category. And indeed, there may higher level you may find stimulation there, but the general thing is the the art of the substitution on the ring modifies the nature and defines the nature of the action. Specifically, I don't know, I cannot be specific to the molecules you're mentioning. We'll probably get to a piece of paper and begin scribbling structures. But there are many, many things that are potentially active as psychedelics and have not been assayed, have not been tasted. The whole art of taking an unknown compound and beginning to find out what its action is going to be, it sounds naively simple. You just start taking more and more of it until you turn on. But the truth is your turn on may be a convulsion, it may be sedation, it may be all kinds of other types of actions, so you have to sneak up on a new compound. So if you're at all considering looking at some of these things, I stress be extremely cautious. If they have not been taken in man before, preliminary animal screening to me is worthless. I gave it up 25 years ago. I killed a number of mice and felt very bad about it. you have to take yourself as the test animal. And that means you start at a level that you are confident will have no action whatsoever. And if you're not that confident, you start at 1,000th of that level. You start at a small amount and be patient. And all be aware of the fact that if you take an unknown material too frequently every day or every 2 days, you may build up a lack of sensitivity to the responses and, in essence, immunize yourself from response. It's a long process. Fortunately, you can do half a dozen things, different compounds not at the same time, but on sequential days, and the chances of cross-tolerance is small. But if you are getting into any new materials based upon basic new ring groups, go with extraordinary caution and keep good notes.
Okay, can I make one comment in regards to the MDMA and memory, you know, that the other person posted? I went through a period where, you know, I probably recklessly used MDMA regularly, and I never noticed any memory loss due to that. My father, who's never done a drug in his life, starting at age 50, definitely started to decline in memory, you know. So I just thought that would be a good comment to make in regards to that.
I think we didn't quite get the full question about memory loss, but on the other hand, we should go on to the next questioner because otherwise we're not going to make it.
First, a clarification. I was at the Berkeley patients group when you spoke, and you recommended a research chemical. I think it was 2CT2. Is that correct?
2CT2 is the first of the active thiophenethylamines, yes.
Okay, thank you. And the second question is a bit more... you also mentioned a story about scopolamine. Mm-hmm. Does that have any relation with Datura?
Oh, scopolamine is a component in Datura.
Oh, okay. Cool. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Yes. So there are about a half a dozen quite strangely different plants that have scopolamine as the major active component. Scopolamine, though, is much more of a hallucinogenic than a psychedelic. In that you see things that are not there. You do not recall too well what you did see. And it is a memory loss, an amnesia type of chemical. Never, never take scopolamine. Two warnings on scopolamine. Don't ever use it if without a babysitter, because you're apt to go through doors that are not never been opened before. And they're still closed when you go through them, so you have someone to pick you up. And the other thing is about one person in five, maybe 500, is hypersensitive to scopolamine. So if the person's never tried scopolamine at all before, try it at a tenth of the expected dosage. And if there's no action, then you go to a normal dosage.
What is the worst thing that can happen if you're hypersensitive to it?
It'll be active at one tenth the normal dosage. It's a potency.
Wow. Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what your opinion is on ibogaine, and are there any other molecules, analogs to it, that might be useful for drug addiction and things of that nature?
On ibogaine, my personal response to it was quite negative, and I chose not to pursue it very far. But that was 40, 50 years ago. I have heard of the actual ceremonies, the rituals that are performed in Africa with the Tabernanthi Iboga. And who's our Italian friend who went through
Giorgio Samarini, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He went through them twice. And it's, in essence, they use it as a...
It's a death experience.
It's a death experience, yes. They use it as a way of embracing the transformation from the early child to the adult, and it's used in that ritual. The work that's being done with it in the treatment of drug addiction is, I believe, showing a rather good promise. I know of two or three cases that have been quite successful. There are a couple of cases in which the person has reverted. I know of a case where the person reverted to his original drug that he was addicted to, but that because of his social surrounding. And then there's the situation of that one horrible, sad thing in France.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how many years ago it was, about 5 or 6. There was a government-approved research study going on in Switzerland studying the effects of MDMA. And it was a group of psychiatrists. And somewhere along the line, one of the psychiatrists, whose name I will not mention, for some reason took one of his patients. There's a woman who was severely depressed. He took her to France, or they both were in France. In any case, that's where the experiment happened. There was no contract made. Now, I wrote as much as I could in the second book, Tikal, about making the contract with the patient before you start on any trip or any experiment with any consciousness-changing drug. And the contract, I think, is vital. Well, no such thing was done. And what he gave her was ibogaine, but it was thought for quite some time afterwards by the various authorities that he'd given her MDMA, because he was one of the psychiatrists in this research project. So in response to that first impression, they shut down the Swiss research for quite a while. In any case, he gave this lady ibogaine, being in a state of emotional pain and having been there for a very long time. She apparently saw the death door, which is an experience some of you have had and I have had, and it's always welcoming, and it tells you, you know, this is the way home when it's time for you to go. It doesn't pull you in. It's just there. And she must have seen it, and she went. Now, most people, when they are not supposed to go over into the afterlife, are sent back. But she never came back. So the psychiatrist had a dead patient on his hands. And I believe personally that ibogaine is a tremendously powerful drug, that it should never be used with a deeply depressed patient, and that at all times a contract should be made between a psychiatrist and patient.
Why don't you tell the underlying terms of that contract?
No, because we don't have time for the full thing, and they can read it in Tikal. Get Tikal out of your library. And I've explained it there.
Mm-hmm. At the time you wrote Pikal and Tikal, the analog laws were on the books, but they had never really been enforced and were more or less kind of theoretical. In the time since then, a dozen or two of the analogs were commercially available. And last summer, in Operation Web Trip, the DEA went and arrested a bunch of people. We got a guy who's doing a life sentence now. What do you think the implications of these cases are for future research like what you do?
Whoa.
In the United States.
In the United States,
yeah.
Well, the analog bill is it passed in 1986, I believe it was, the Controlled Substance Analog Bill. It is one of the most legally vague descriptions I've ever seen in any law of what a thing is, their definition of what an analog is. No, what the definition of what a controlled substance analog is. I wrote a letter to the Journal of Forensic Sciences, to the editor, in which I titled, How Similar is Substantially Similar, was the name of the thing, because the law does not say that these two things have to be similar. Are these two things similar? Yes. Well, there's five of these and one of these, and this has a little water, and this has no water in it. But they are certainly similar. Or in essence, you could say they're substantially the same. But the law says two things that are of structures, and the second part of the law, activity, and the third part of the law, of the definition, intended use, that is substantially similar to a Schedule I drug. And I got into this letter was a consequence of being called as an expert witness when I was asked. What's not widely known, and I believe it is still correct today, MDMA, for example, is not illegal in California. It's not in California law. MDA is, but not MDMA. So if someone is arrested for MDMA in California by California authorities, the only way they can process it in court is to treat it as an analog of, say, methamphetamine. And as an analog, you have the problem of establishing that it has a structure that is substantially similar to that of methamphetamine. And I was in this case down in somewhere toward Los Angeles, and I was asked by the prosecuting attorney if these two compounds had structures that are substantially similar, and I pleaded to the judge, and he was very kind, saying, I don't understand the question. And the judge asked the man to rephrase the question, and he could not rephrase the question because he had to use those exact wordings from the law. It was written that way. And so he said, well, let's drop that question. Do they have actions in man that are substantially similar? And so I turned to his honor and said, I looked at him. He asked, could you rephrase the question? And couldn't rephrase the question. And I was, that was the end of it. I left the court. I couldn't answer the questions. I couldn't understand the questions. And so I was a worthless expert witness. The humorous, sad consequences, they brought another forensic person from another laboratory and asked her, do you understand, in a voir dire, do you understand the meaning of substantially similar? And she said that is a phrase that is known very well by all chemists and forensic chemists. It's a very well understood phrase. They asked her, would you define two things being substantially similar? She said, very simple. They're substantially similar if they're over 50% identical. And that held up, and the jury found the person guilty. But this is the problem of the analog things. Anything is potentially a controlled substance analog of a scheduled drug if it has carbon in it, or if it has nitrogen in it, or has hydrogen or oxygen. There are many ways that they're substantially similar. And except for two cases I know, a very early one, the second one was one where they caught one of the professional forensic people lying on the stand and dismissed the case. I don't know of any controlled substance analog trials that have failed. They have almost always been successful to the prosecutors. And I say that the materials that are in PCAL and TCAL are all, in the eyes of the authorities, substantially similar to a Schedule I drug and can be treated in court that way. Well, one thing that is not widely known about the federal controlled, it's also the state controlled substance law, is that they call them hallucinogenics, not psychedelics. For hallucinogenics only, isomers, optical isomers, positional isomers, optical, positional, and one other definition of isomers will apply to these materials that are called hallucinogens. And so they have, in essence, broadened the, say, substitution isomers are automatically in the controlled substance law. They're not analogs. And one of my favorite examples of this is what I would call MMDA 4, which is 2,3-methanedioxy-5 methoxyamphetamine is technically a Schedule I drug because it is a positional isomer of MMDA, and yet, to my knowledge, has never yet been synthesized. No one succeeded. I've tried many ways and failed every time, and to my knowledge, it's still not in the chemical literature. And yet, once a person has completed the synthesis and has the material, he is guilty of a felony, even though it's the first time it's ever been synthesized, so it's interesting to see what might happen there. I'm sorry, I got rattled off into other topics.
And perhaps it's entirely up to you whether you want to make shorter answers and finish all these people or not. We've only got a little under 10 minutes left. So, with that warning, I've forgotten which side we're
right
after.
Here.
Yes, you are.
Well, first of all, deep gratitude to both of you for all your work and your willingness to share so much with us. I have two questions. The other night, Sasha, we were having a conversation about ecstasy, and you were talking about, I think you called it sort of that first-time magical effect and how you kind of lose that with the ongoing use. I was wondering, Anne, what was your experience around that when you were using it weekly for a year and a half, and do you feel it's, quote, safe to use it that often?
The fact is that as I used, it's not ecstasy to us. We refuse to call it ecstasy because the term ecstasy could mean anything these days. So we call it MDMA still. As I used it once a week, pretty much that often, yes, I had to gradually add a little more each time. It was when I got to 250 milligrams with a booster of 100 milligrams that I said to myself something like, maybe I'd better stop taking this for a while because I'm taking too much. About a year later, I tried MDMA again for the first time in a year, and I have no idea what the meaning of this really is, but it had an opposite effect than usual. Instead of that wonderful mellowing kind of thing, it depressed me. I was quite depressed, and I have not tried it since. I think I wrecked it for myself by taking it too often. But I do not, for myself, I can only answer for myself, I don't think it had any negative effects whatsoever. I'm just sorry that I can't use it anymore, and I'm sorry that it's illegal.
And then the other question was, in that conversation with Sasha, he mentioned that you used to work with a hypnotherapist when you were doing your lay therapy with MDMA. So could you talk a little bit about that?
Very fast. I worked with a hypnotherapist for about almost 2 years. And we discovered that at that time we could use MDMA, that the trance state and MDMA and other real psychedelics, they work very well together. But I like to tell people that the hypnotic trance state is, I believe, fully as good as any drug in opening those doors inside a person's psyche. And I do believe that instead of risking legal problems, you should go to a good hypnotherapist and find out how to discover yourself that way.
At least
while the laws are as they are.
Thank you.
Yeah, picking up on the last questioner, I know several people who have been using MDMA for well over 20 years on a weekly basis and have not lost the magical quality of it. So that's just a comment. But my question pertains to the love story part of your writings, which has drawn me in and deeply charmed me. And I found myself scouring for characterizations of various compounds that related to feelings of love, to the types of neuromodulation that, you know, accompanies that. And I'm wondering if you'd care to just present a brief survey of what you know about substances that delve into those aspects, those wonderful aspects of being alive and feeling that those types of feelings?
I do a fast answer on this. Sasha usually tries to remind people that it isn't the drug that is giving you an experience, whether it's one of love or anything else. It is your own psyche. The drugs act as keys to the inner doors. And DMT will definitely open a different door than mescaline. But it's all still what's inside you. And I think maybe that's the best answer I can give.
Yeah, the term I use, and I like it very much, is the drug itself cannot do anything. It's just a few milligrams of white crystalline solid cannot open these doors. It merely catalyzes the opening of the door and allows you to do the opening yourself. So really, the drug serves as a catalyst, not as an active agent.
Thank you.
We're not going to be able to, and I'm afraid this will have to be the last question. I do apologize to those of you who are still waiting over there.
So I had read a review or something where you guys were talking about in the last couple of years some work you had done with cacti, and it wasn't mescaline or anything, phenethylamine, I don't think. And I was curious what that was. There weren't any further details. So,
could you repeat that word?
Cactus. Cacti.
Cactus. Oh.
Okay, one of the ones that I really put a fair amount of effort in is a cactus from Baja California known as Pachycerus pringlii. It's a cactus grows in the Table Mountains about halfway down Baja. And it is a very active cactus. Anna and I have both used it two times. And it contains no trace of mescaline whatsoever. So I've been digging into what's in there. I have identified about 8 or 10 compounds, and I've characterized maybe another dozen compounds. Most of them are isoquinolines, and I have synthesized two or three of them and tried them, and they're not active. There are some phenethylamines that are present, but they're known not to be active in man. Dimethoxy phenethylamine. There's one in there, methylene dioxy and methylphenethylamine. But they are, if they are destroyed by the body's system, and I believe now that the cactus is active because the isoquinolines are monoamine oxidase inhibitors and keeps the body from deaminating the materials that are normally deaminated in the body and are therefore not active. So the cactus is almost like ayahuasca. Any component alone is not active, but in mixture they are. And I would like to now continue back over these phenethylamines using monoamine oxidase inhibitors to see if that could be the justification for the activity of the cactus. I do not know the answer.
Thanks.
But we're still working on it.
Oh, yes.
Thank you very much indeed, Sasha and Anne. Long may they continue working at it and giving us the benefit of their experience.
You're listening to the Psychedelic Salon, where people are changing their lives one thought at a time.
Now, if you think you've heard this talk before, you may be partially correct. June 6th, 2006 was the approximate anniversary of my first year of doing this podcast. And so for the program that day, I think it was podcast number 39, I played several short selections from several speakers at this conference, but today you heard their entire session. So I hope that now you have a little better idea of the chemist side of the Shulgins, and should you have some time in the distant past when these ABC drugs were still legal, should you have ingested one of these little gems like 2CB, you know that a lot of work went into designing that experience for you. And yes, Sasha and Anne and their merry little band of deep space explorers did just that for us. They designed experiences. Now, most of you, I'm sure, already own a copy of Anne and Sasha's books, Pecal and Tecal. But if you don't, you can buy copies through Amazon from your local bookstore or directly from Shulgin's by emailing their publisher at Transform Press, that's all one word, Transform Press at yahoo.com, where the price is $24.50 each. And you can just send an email to Transform Press and get the details directly from them. My guess is that once you've held a copy of these books in your hands, you're going to have a copy for yourself. And if you haven't already begun to build your own psychedelic library, these two books are a perfect place to begin. For one thing, they're divided into two parts. And the first part is the story. Now, they bill it as a novel, but if you read it closely, you'll discover that maybe you even know some of these characters, at least the people the characters are based on. And then you'll discover that there is, at least maybe a kernel of truth here and there in this story. And then, if you're like I was when I first found Pikal, out in the boondocks with no friends who even smoked cannabis, working in the system, burdened with debt, hating my job, and then you read this great story that you somehow just know has to have a lot of truth in it, and for the first time in many years, you have hope once again. And then you begin part two and discover some 500 or more pages of chemical recipes. Do you want to know more about 2CB? Just go to page 503, where you'll find detailed protocol for making it, followed by information about dosage and duration. And then come the qualitative comments and Sasha's extension and commentary. Now, I'm not sure about this number, but there are over 30 index pages with about 40 lines each. That's in Pikal, at least, which means there are over 1,000 entries, and the vast majority of them are names of chemicals. And these are only the phenethylamines that he created and tested. The tryptamines are detailed in Tikal. Now think back for a second about some of the things that we just heard Sasha say about first the problem of figuring out which compounds will be psychoactive and then building them, but the second problem of human testing and how painfully slow it absolutely must be. Because if this kind of testing isn't painfully slow, it most certainly can become painful and maybe even painfully dead. So if there are any budding chemists out there that are listening to this, please keep Sasha's words in mind at all times. Anyway, when you pick up copies of Pikal and Tikal and fan through those thousands of pages, then see if you don't agree that Sasha Shulgin is a chemist that is truly worthy of a Nobel Prize. Wow, you know, I've been saying that for years now, but just now, just as the words were coming out of my mouth, I suddenly realized that this is the first time I've said that since Dr. Hoffman died, because I always follow it by adding that Albert Hoffman is equally worthy of the joint Nobel Prize in chemistry. Of course, the fact that Dr. Hoffman was a member of the Nobel Selection Committee probably prevented him from receiving the award himself. But now, dear Albert has moved on to a new adventure. So I guess the mantle of the world's greatest chemist is now yours alone, Sasha. The king is dead. Long live the king. Can you believe I'm getting so corny today? All I'm trying to say is that I'm sad that Dr. Hoffman has left the ship, but I'm overjoyed that Sasha is recovering, albeit at a pace that he's bristling at. Anyway, get well, Sasha, and our love also goes out to you, Anne, and Tanya, and Greg, who are there to help Sasha get back on his feet. Now, regarding the Shulgin's talk that we just heard, I want to emphasize what Anne was saying about the potential MDMA therapy has for veterans of war suffering from PTSD. First of all, if that is you, or if you know someone in that situation, you might want to think about contacting Dr. Michael Mithoffer, who has been conducting FDA-approved tests using MDMA therapy with post-traumatic stress disorder victims. And you can find links to him in our psychedelicsalon.org blog. The reason I say that is because in my own case, at least it's my belief that working through some of my Navy issues while with friends and on MDMA, well, that's the main reason I'm still alive today. Now, I was never diagnosed with PTSD, and I really don't think I had it. I don't think that's the case. But I can say for certain that the bizarre dreams that frequently woke me up with my own screaming, well, they went away after I went through some of these sessions, and now they seem to have gone away forever. But unsupervised, that is, without some kind of experienced, hopefully professional, help, MDMA may not be that great of an idea. Believe me, in my case, I know for sure that it can be a great party drug. In fact, since there was no information about it when I first started using it, I seriously abused it. Seriously. Until it didn't work at all, in any dose, and believe me, I tried some dangerously large ones. So I stopped completely for 2 years, tried again, but nothing, not even a tingle. So I stopped for 7 more years and tried it again. And then, like magic, it was almost as good as the first time. And after that, I never used it more than 2 or 3 times a year, and it worked perfectly every time. Now, it's been a really long time now since I've used it, so I'm sure it would work well, even though I once was almost a daily user. But now I avoid it because of the body load. One thing I've learned with aging is that it is even more important to listen to your body as you get older. And when you're grinding teeth and the second day drop or lull or whatever you call it begin to get to you, well, maybe it's time to move on to greener pastures, like ayahuasca, for example, or one of the other bold-faced chemicals in the index. Now, before I run out of steam for today, I'd like to mention a thread from our forum over on thegrowreport.com. It comes from one of our fellow saloners who goes by the handle Impermanence, and he brings up a really good point, one that once we get past the semantics is something that I probably should bring up here. So thank you in advance, Impermanence. I appreciate your candor. And I'm not going to read the entire thread, but I will read part of how Impermanence began it, and then a few bits of the responses. But if this topic interests you, I recommend that you go to the Psychedelic Salon Forum on thegrowreport.com and look for the thread titled, A Bone to Pick with Lorenzo. Here's how it begins. The bone I have to pick is regarding Lorenzo's opinion of cannabis being non-addictive. Sure, cannabis is not physically addictive, and you may have had no physical withdrawal symptoms, but it is without a doubt incredibly mentally addictive. And I, for one, have suffered physical withdrawal symptoms every time I've tried to give up cannabis. Now let me interrupt right here so I can get my little semantic thing out of the way. And that has to do with the word addictive. The reason I want to clear the air on that term first is because the rest of what Impermanence has to say is something I think we should take very seriously. But here's my problem with the word addiction. And I confess to being a disciple of Jonathan Ott on this. I don't have the time to go into it in detail right now, but eventually I'll play one of his talks about what it really means to be addicted. But just to give you something to chew on, how come here in the States, where coffee breaks are actually written into labor contracts, and where almost everyone has several cups of coffee each and every single day, how come we don't mention the fact that all of these people are addicted to caffeine? Because that is, in fact, exactly what they are. And if somebody who drinks 2 or more cups of coffee a day claims that they aren't addicted, well, tell them to quit cold turkey and give you a call around the 4th or 5th day and let you know how they're doing with their withdrawal symptoms. Now take the same case with daily cannabis smoker, toker, or vaporizer, and they'll call you to say that they haven't had a single physical symptom of withdrawal. My point being somewhat anally technical, but until coffee drinkers admit that they are addicts, and see how bad that word sounds? Until those coffee addicts admit their dependency, I don't think us cannabis users should give up any ground and allow ourselves to be called an addict, even if we are using a non-medical phrase like mentally addictive. Now, I do know what you're talking about, Impermanence, but I feel quite strongly that we shouldn't open the door to creating any more negative impressions of the psychedelic community than necessary. We're perfectly capable of doing that in many more creative ways. Anyway, if we get rid of the addict thoughts and go with something like serious psychological dependency or something like that, then the rest of Impermanence post really resonates with me. And in point of fact, Impermanence makes the same point a couple of days later when he said, maybe I shouldn't be using the word addictive. What I should be saying is I have a psychological dependence to cannabis. And I think he also mentioned that he was a little drunk when he made his original post, which I'll continue reading now. I'm a 29-year-old male who has been smoking cannabis since the tender age of 12. I can't give up. In Ireland, it's mostly indica hash from Afghanistan that we get on the street. I've been smoking this shit my whole life. I love it, and I'm miserable without it. I suffer headaches without hash. I can't sleep. I'm incredibly moody. In fact, intolerable. I will drink myself into oblivion if I can't get sorted for hash or weed. But I always do. I get sorted and continue living in my hazy bubble. Without cannabis, my central nervous system goes to overdrive. I become erratic and inconsolably moody and depressed. I have turned to smoking heroin on many occasions when I couldn't get cannabis over the last few years. I'm not alone in my addiction. I have seen cannabis destroy the lives of many friends, rob the strong ones of their passion and motivation, and leave them a shell of what they once were, and lead the weak ones into heroin addiction. I've seen them die. It began with an addiction to cannabis. I think Lorenzo is living in a fantasy world sometimes. I want to believe it, but on the streets of Dublin, cannabis is not some fucking fairy tale. It's just relief from stress. And if abused through unprepared or immature minds, it comes with a heavy price. I never mentioned my struggle with psychosis that's left me agoraphobic for 10 years, thanks largely to cannabis. I'm hoping ayahuasca will help me deal with that because giving up cannabis is not in the cards. I would rather die than never smoke a joint again. Now tell me cannabis is not addictive. Well, as you might suspect, this original post led to quite a few responses. And a few thoughts I had began with remembering the alcoholic haze I lived in before I found psychedelics. And as an aside note to our fellow saloners from the DEA and other agencies of note who may think I just replaced one vice for another, well, maybe you're right. But from where I stand, I feel it's much healthier for me to participate in a few ayahuasca ceremonies each year and smoke a joint from time to time than it was to drink myself into a stupor every day. And in a way, it sounds like impermanence was doing more than his or her share of drinking. And as for being agoraphobic for 10 years, he says thanks largely to cannabis, well, maybe you should have quit buying that indica and tried a little Jack Herer instead. Seriously. But another little trick that I've discovered that might help you daily tokers out there is to begin each day with a little list of things that you absolutely intend to get done for the day. And do this before your first toke. Then toke all you want as long as your list is getting checked off. But if you miss getting everything done that day, then you don't allow yourself to toke at all the next day. And if you're serious about that promise to yourself, then you'll be surprised how much work you can get done while you're stoned. You know, the old carrot and stick program. That said, getting into the rut of being stoned every day isn't a bed of roses from a psychological point of view, and over the long term can be very detrimental. And I should probably interject here that both Anne and Sasha Shulgin strongly warn against heavy use of cannabis, and in fact, neither of them are fond of it personally. On the other hand, I admit that cannabis is my closest ally. Yet, very interestingly, the spirit of that plant, if you get to know it well and listen closely, will let you know when it's time to back off. Just a few months back, I found it quite fascinating that, along with myself, almost a dozen or so of my friends, almost spontaneously, and all without talking to one another beforehand, well, we all went on a break, an indefinite hiatus from using that wonderful plant. And I think that most of us didn't use it again for several months, just quit cold turkey, because it seemed like the right thing to do at the moment. In fact, I can remember thinking during my hiatus that I might not ever even want to use it again. And in fact, I realized that I didn't need to. But, of course, eventually I dusted off the old doctor's recommendation and stopped by the local dispensary once again, mainly because it was getting too painful to sit at my computer for more than an hour or so a day. But after I started back once again, I realized how much I missed the feeling the way I feel when I'm high. Now, let's be honest here. We humans have been altering our consciousness long before we even figured out how to brew beer. If you watch, you'll see even little children spinning themselves around in small circles just to get dizzy and get that feeling of being high. You know, it's in our nature to be high. At least that's my unscientific opinion. So maybe we're chasing the wrong moonbeam here. Maybe we shouldn't be talking about being psychologically dependent upon cannabis, but instead talk about being psychologically dependent on feeling good or having a relaxed and peaceful state of mind. Maybe that's what this calling to pursue this exploration of inner space is all about. Who knows? I for sure don't know what drives us to have these unusual experiences and then come back to places like the Psychedelic Salon and talk about them. Why aren't you listening to some good music right now? And by the way, I hope you do just that really soon, because all this talking can wear you out after a while. And music's the perfect break. By the way, did you know that Sasha is also an excellent musician? I believe it's the cello that he plays. But the question remains, why are you using some of your valuable time in this life to listen to a bunch of lectures when you could be out playing golf or something? I can't speak for everybody, but my guess is that most of our fellow saloners stop by the salon each week and are part of the global psychedelic community because they have no choice. We're drawn here like moths to a flame. So let's be moths that enjoy the light, but stay out of the fire. Well, I've got five more things I want to mention today, but I'm going to save them for the next podcast. I think we've all got enough to think about right now for one day. And I do want to thank John Hanna for producing the Mind States conferences and to JT for recording them and allowing me to use them here in the salon. And most of all, I want to thank Ann and Sasha, not only for today's podcast, but for everything the two of you and your brave little band of human guinea pigs have done for all of us humans. You have all delivered to us the perfect medicine our species needs to continue on this fascinating journey. And as always, I want to close by saying that this and all of the podcasts from the Psychedelic Salon are available under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 3.0 license. And if you have any questions about that, just click the Creative Commons link at the bottom of the Psychedelic Salon webpage, which you can find at psychedelicsalon.org. And that's also where you'll find the program notes for these podcasts. And for now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.